renouncers, the embodiment of existence, knowledge, bliss absolute, and who removes all our miseries. Om, peace, peace, peace. Om Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Mrutam Gamaya Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Om peace, peace, peace be unto us, peace be unto all. So we continue with Sadhana Panchakam, 5 verses on spiritual practices. We'll see the 8th practice today. Now, Nijagrihat Turnam Vinirgamyatam. Swiftly give up attachment to your household. So obviously, this teaching, all these teachings pertain to everyone. To a sannyasin, to a devotee who is single, or to a householder. So swiftly give up attachment to your household. Now how to give up attachment to our household? These are my people, these are my possessions, this is my house. Sri Ramakrishna teaches how to live in the world free from this feeling of I and mine. But it doesn't eliminate the ego. Sri Ramakrishna speaks of 2 kinds of ego. Unripe ego and ripe ego. Unripe ego bases itself on mind and body. These are my people, these are my possessions. All this is based on my attachment to the mind and body, which makes me feel a limited individual. So these are mine, these people are mine, these possessions are mine. So this mind derives itself, it bases itself on the body, on the mind. This is unripe ego. Sri Ramakrishna says, there is what is called ripe ego, which shifts its location, locus, from the body and mind to the spirit beyond them. I am a child of God. I am the spirit. I am not the body. I am not the mind. God is whole, I am part. God is the master and I am his servant. This also needs ego. There are no 2 egos, but that ego which had its locus on mind and body is now transformed. We re-educate the ego and make it dwell on the spirit rather than on the body and on the mind. So I am a child of God. I am the spirit. I am a spark of the divine fire. This is ripe ego. That means it bases itself on God. Sri Ramakrishna says, when this question was posed to him, how to live in the world and grow in detachment. Sri Ramakrishna says, live in the world like a maidservant in a rich man's house. This is a traditional example that you find often in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. It lends itself to a lot of reflection. Maidservant in a rich man's house, she looks upon the children of her master, the rich man, to be her own. He serves them, he feeds them, she serves them, she feeds them, clothes them. We read in the Gospel, she looks upon them as if he is my Hari like this, my Hari doesn't like this. So she serves the master's children as if they are her own. But she remembers that her own place is elsewhere, her own children are elsewhere. Because she looks upon these people as master's children, the quality of her service to them doesn't diminish. In fact, the quality of her service to them should be the highest, because only then she'll be retained by the master. So similarly, says Sri Ramakrishna, when you live in the world, instead of looking upon your family as my husband, my wife, my children, look upon yourself first as a child of God, and look upon your wife, your husband, as a child of God, your children also as children of God. And you have some responsibilities being the head of the family, being married to your husband, your wife, and the children. And these responsibilities you discharge, looking upon them as the Master's children, God's children. You look upon yourself as a child of God, and look upon them also as children of God. That way your eye still remains, but it is no more rooted in the body and the mind, but it is rooted in the spirit. That way, we continue to love them, we continue to discharge our responsibilities to them, but we become gradually free from attachment to the household. It's only spiritual life is lived in the mind. We continue to do our duties, but our attitude becomes different. We look upon whatever we do as worship of God. So when the maidservant looks upon the master's children as if they are her own, the quality of our service is really, it cannot be any less than perfect. Similarly, we serve our husband, our wife, our children to the best of our ability because they are God's children. So we continue to do what we have been doing, but since the focus shifts from our body and mind, it also shifts from the husband's or wife's body and mind, and also from the children. But we gradually focus ourselves on the spirit. So this helps us grow in devotion. This helps us grow proportionately in detachment from the world. And Sri Ramakrishna said, for every sincere spiritual seeker, monk, nun, householder, or single, what is required is mental renunciation. Those who can renounce externally by God's grace, they practice both external renunciation and internal renunciation. But internal renunciation or mental renunciation is required for everyone. Without this internal renunciation, spiritual progress doesn't become possible. So Sri Ramakrishna again and again mentions this. Try to detach yourself mentally by focusing the attention on God. Swami Vivekananda says in his lecture, God in Everything, under Jnana Yoga. This God in Everything is a wonderful lecture. It's a wonderful exposition of the Ishavasya Upanishad by Swami Vivekananda. This brief Upanishad, hardly 9 or 10 mantras. There are some elliptical verses in this Upanishad which cannot be easily understood despite Sri Shankara's commentary. They don't somehow seem to make a contemporaneous relevance when we study them repeatedly. But when we study this commentary of Swami Vivekananda on the Ishavasya Upanishad, suddenly things that were obscure begin to clear up. We get a new understanding. That is one important point we keep in mind. Sri Ramakrishna says, when we study the scriptures in the light of holy men's teachings, we are able to study the essence of the scriptures. Because sometimes we need to wade through a lot of wooded area before we come across some sandalwood tree. When we were discussing study of scriptures, I didn't mention one point, and that is an important Sanskrit verse which goes like this. Our scriptures are infinite. There's a lot to be learned. And the time at our disposal is very limited, and obstacles are very many. Scriptures are infinite. Ananta shastram bahuveditavyam. There is a lot to be known. Alpashcha kalo bahavashcha vigna. Time at our disposal is very less. Means what? Our life is short. That is one interpretation. Second, in our everyday routine, how many minutes are we able to earmark for studies? That's the idea. So we have very limited time at our disposal for study of scriptures. Study of spiritual teachings. When we say study of scriptures, we already saw that for devotees of Sri Ramakrishna, it is the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, Holy Mother, Swamiji's teachings, and teachings of the direct disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. So scriptures are infinite, there is a lot to be known. Time at our disposal is less, and obstacles are many. All this resonates with us. And then, therefore, one should learn the essence of the scriptures. One should learn to separate the essence of the scriptures, just as the legendary swan separates milk from a mixture of milk and water. So that's an important verse about scriptures. Swami Vivekananda says this in his commentary on the Ishavasya Upanishad, God in everything. We have to cover everything with the Lord Himself, not by a false sort of optimism, not by blinding our eyes to the evil, but by really seeing God in everything. Thus, we have to give up the world, and when the world is given up, what remains? God. What is meant? You can have your wife. It does not mean that you are to abandon her, but that you are to see God in the wife. Give up your children. What does that mean? To turn them out of doors, as some human brutes do in every country? Certainly not. That is diabolism. It is not religion. But see God in your children. So in everything, in life and in death, in happiness and in misery, the Lord is equally present. The whole world is full of the Lord. Open your eyes and see Him. This is what Vedanta teaches. This is Swami Vivekananda's commentary on the very first mantra, Ishavasimidam Sarvam Yatkincha Jagatyan Jagat. And Swami Vivekananda continues, give up the world which you have conjectured, the world we have been thinking of so long, the world to which we have been clinging so long, is a false world of our own creation. Give that up, open your eyes and see that as such it never existed. It was a dream, Maya. What existed was the Lord Himself. It is He who is in the child, in the wife, and in the husband. It is He who is in the good and in the bad. He is in the sin and in the sinner. He is in life and in death. And how to grow in this detachment? How to grow in this detachment from our household? Sri Ramakrishna repeatedly gives this advice. Those who live in the world should periodically retire into solitude. When we retire into solitude, that means we retire from our familiar environment. When we retire into solitude, we pray to God. We pray to God, those who think are my own are really not mine. You alone are mine. And give me devotion to you. And Sri Ramakrishna says, one should reflect on the fact that this world is fleeting. Anityam, asukam, lokam. So this world is fleeting. So give me devotion to you. Give me love for your divine name. Reduce in me desire for sense objects. May I not be deluded by your world-bewitching maya. So we find these prayers in the gospel. So Sri Ramakrishna says, we should retire into solitude now and then. Now again, what is solitude? Solitude where there is no human habitation, we really retire into that place, it is good. But to derive benefit from this kind of a solitude, where we don't see another soul, we should have had some mental preparation. Otherwise, our own mind will act as our enemy, because we carry our mind with us. The mind will imagine so many things, and some people will get really crazy, mad, and would want to retire to their familiar surroundings. This very meeting, I would say, I am fond of telling our congregation that this congregation itself, when we become part of this congregation, we come to the center. Each one of us is in solitude, if we look upon it that way. When we look upon it that way, we don't consider this to be a means for socializing with people. This is to think of God, to hear about higher life, and exchange notes on our spiritual life. So if we look upon this as solitude, we can such meetings as solitude, your weekly classes as solitude, we can pray to God, reflect on the evanescence of life. and reflect on the fact that I and God alone exist. We try to forget our familiar surroundings, at least for a moment. Mahapurush Maharaj, Swami Shivanandaji, one of the 16 monastic disciples of Sri Ramakrishna, he was president of the order, and monks and brahmacharis, after their morning meditation, would go to his room, offer salutations to him, sit at his feet, and hear words of wisdom from him. Mahapurush Maharaj asked one of the monks who was before him, "Are you able to meditate regularly?" The monk said, "I try to meditate regularly, but thoughts of work connected with the monastery keep coming to my mind, thoughts related to my work." Now what we would think? A monk's responsibilities in the monastery, he is not supposed to have any selfish interest. So these are thoughts about his work in the monastery, which should be welcome. Certainly, these thoughts are welcome compared to any other debasing thoughts, weakening thoughts. But Mahapurush Maharaj said, when you meditate, remember that you and Ramakrishna alone exist. Ramakrishna mission doesn't exist. You and Ramakrishna alone exist. And you and whatever Ishta Devata we meditate on, that alone exists. So we try to forget the world. By world in Vedanta means everything beginning from my mind. My mind, senses, body, and everything outside that I perceive. I'm supposed to get detached from all this and think of God who is present within. We are taught to meditate on the presence. We don't try to meditate on a picture of Sri Ramakrishna, Holy Mother, or our Ishta Devata. But we try to imagine that God is present this moment. That is visualizing His presence. That means we are in the present tense. The mind doesn't go to the future. The mind is not supposed to go to the past, which is its normal, natural mode. But when we feel His presence, the mind tends to remain in the present. That's an important point. We don't try to recollect a picture of our Ishta Devata. We don't think of a picture placed in our heart. But God is here. I'm not able to see Him. That's a different thing. Suppose someone worthy of our adoration is in the adjacent room. We are not able to see. Our own Guru has come, or Sri Ramakrishna Himself is there in the adjacent room. Suppose we are aware that they are in the adjacent room. We are not able to see them. So we have a particular mindset at that time. They are there. When we have that mindset, that is what is called presence. We know that they are present. So similarly, in our heart, they are present, though I'm not able to see them right away. But visualizing the presence helps rivet the mind to the present. So we visualize the presence. So this is an important point in spiritual practice. This helps us conserve our mental energies, which get frittered away when the mind goes to the future or to the past, taking us along with it. So this is Sri Ramakrishna's teaching on solitude. We have some, by way of a spiritual practice in this very hymn, we have teachings about solitude too. But this teaching was about growing in detachment from the household. Swiftly give up attachment to your household. One of our senior swamis used to say, "It's all right to be a householder, but let not the house hold you." It's a mindset. So whatever we are, by God's grace, whatever station of life we are in, we are a householder, we are single, we are a monk, we are a nun, it's by God's grace. So wherever we are, let not the house hold us. We don't need to think that we are a householder, after all we are householders, what can we do? No. We are children of God. Every devotee of Sri Ramakrishna, Holy Mother and Swami Vivekananda thinks of themselves as children of God. I am not a man, I am not a woman, but I am the Spirit. I am a child of God. I have divine parents. I myself am divine. So this helps us grow in detachment from the household. The next practice. We saw 8 practices now. That means we have studied 1 verse out of the 5 verses. Now the second verse. Because we reflect on related related thoughts. And as I said, we don't have a syllabus to complete before this retreat is over. We can always reflect on more. But whatever we reflect on, we'll reflect on related thoughts, so that these things, there are chances of these things getting imprinted in our mind. Verse 2, Sangat Satsu Vidhiyatam. Sangha Satsu Vidhiyatam. Remain in the company of the holy. This is about holy company. Holy company refers to physical holy company, that is very clear. But physical holy company is not always possible. But congregation, company of like-minded people like you, congregating for a divine purpose, that is equally a potent holy company. And then we have holy company from books, for seekers of God, spiritual, for seekers of God, teachings of Mahapurush Maharaj, spiritual treasures, letters of Swami Turiyananda, eternal companion, teachings of Swami Brahmananda. So these books just indicative. You have other books too. Or some devotees form, they jot down notes, inspiring notes from books that they have read, and they form their own book of inspiration. So we go over this regularly. That is holy company. Just as we saw, studying spiritual books helps us orient our mind toward God. It is also supposed to inspire us to do spiritual practice. So holy company is in the form of a holy person. Holy company is in the form of holy thoughts. We think of higher thoughts. Holy company can be in the form of books. And what are the benefits of holy company? Sri Ramakrishna says, By constant living in the company of holy men, the soul becomes restless for God. This yearning is like the state of mind of a man who has someone ill in the family. His mind is in a state of perpetual restlessness, thinking how the sick person may be cured. There is another benefit from holy company. It helps one cultivate discrimination between the real and the unreal. God alone is the real. That is to say, the eternal substance. And the world is unreal. That is to say, transitory. As soon as a man finds his mind wandering away to the unreal, he should apply discrimination. The moment an elephant stretches out its trunk to eat a plantain tree in neighbor's garden, it gets a blow from the iron goad of the driver. So we practice this discrimination. Holy company fosters discrimination in us, discrimination between what will lead us Godward and what will bind us more and more to the world. And we have this important verse in Sri Shankaracharya's Bhajagovindam. Verses on renunciation, worship the God. In fact, we can have that as a topic for one of the retreats sometime. Yeah. All those things you just reflect, there is a lot to be learned from there. So in this Bhajagovindam, there is an important verse, Satsangatve Nisangatvam. I think, Satsangatve Nisangatvam is in Chandogya. In the Bhajagovindam you have, Kshanamapi Sajjana Sangatireka Bhavati Bhavar Navatarane Nauka. Kshanamapi, even a moment, Sajjana Sangatireka, even a moment of holy company can serve as a raft to cross this ocean of relative existence. Bhavati Bhavar Navatarane Nauka. But this one is from the Chandogya Upanishad. Satsangatve Nisangatvam. Satsanga. Sat means good. Sat also means existence absolute. Sat Chit Ananda. So Satsanga means holy company of the spirit, the Atman itself. And those who live a spiritual life, their company also is counted to be Satsanga, holy company. Satsangatve Nisangatvam. Sangha is attachment. Nisanga means free from attachment. When we cultivate holy company, it fosters detachment. Nisangatve Nirmohatvam. Moha is delusion, tamas. When we grow in detachment, we become free from delusion. Nirmohatve Nishchara Tattvam. Nishchara means
unmoving.
No chalana, unmoving, chalati. So Nirmohatve Nishchara Tattvam, Tattvam, knowledge of the Tattva. Tat Tvam Asi, that is Tattvam. Tat is that, Tvam is you, that thou art. So that grasp of the Tattva or grasp of spiritual teachings or realization, that becomes steady. One becomes a sthita prajna, man of steady wisdom. So that becomes, that results from nirmohatva, freedom from delusion. Nirmohatve nishchala tattvam, nishchala tattve jivan mukti. When one's perception of, when one's realization of the infinite reality becomes steady, it leads to freedom while living, jivan mukti. That means we are free as the spirit, though we continue to live in the body and the mind. So this is an important verse from the Chandogya Upanishad. So that's about growing in detachment from, no, that was the previous one, growing in detachment from the household. This is about remaining in the company of the holy. The second teaching is Bhagavato Bhaktihi Dridadhiyatam. That means strengthen your devotion to God. See, all this from Sri Shankaracharya, who was an exponent of monism, non-dualism. How many hymns he composed in praise of so many gods and goddesses. All that for us spiritual seekers. He had to establish the supremacy of the non-dualistic philosophy. So he was uncompromisingly monistic in his commentaries on the Gita, the Upanishads and the Brahma Sutras, because he had a philosophy to uphold and he had to dismiss the views of Buddhists, the Sankhyas and Mimamsakas. So he is worshipped as an incarnation of Shiva himself. But he had great compassion. Shiva, incarnated in the form of Sri Shankara, had great compassion for devotees who won't be able to grasp all of a sudden non-dualistic philosophy. So he composed so many hymns. Annapurnashtakam, you have Saundarya Lahari. There are so many. Bhajagovindam itself. So all this is for us to practice. And there he says, Sri Shankara says, and you have this Devya Parada Kshamapana Stotram, a hymn of forgiveness to the Divine Mother. And there he says, Kuputro Jayeta Kuchidapi Kumata Nabhavati. A bad son may be born sometimes, but never a bad mother. And you have so many useless children like me, but I have only you for my mother. So these are Sri Shankara's outpourings for us. He didn't need these hymns himself for his own spiritual progress. So Sri Shankara says here, strengthen your devotion to God. Bhagavato bhaktihi dridadhiyata. How do we strengthen our devotion to God? This is a subject by itself. But briefly, the Bhagavad Gita is a great pointer in how to cultivate devotion to God. And Sri Ramakrishna's gospel, in every other page, Sri Ramakrishna says, cultivate a relationship with God. Look upon God as your mother. Look upon God as your father. Looking upon God as your mother, Sri Ramakrishna taught, is the purest attitude possible. So we need to cultivate an attitude. God is not someone far away. God is not someone to be feared. But God is our own. He is all love. He is waiting for us to turn our face in His direction. And we remember that example that Sri Ramakrishna gave. As long as the child is busy playing with its toys, the mother lets the child play. But when the child is done with the toys, does not derive any more happiness from the toys, throws away the toys and cries, Mother, the mother comes running from the kitchen, takes the child on her lap and begins to nurse it. This is a wonderful example. God is in no great hurry to wean people from their pursuit of sense enjoyment, sense objects. God lets us play for as long as we are not satisfied with what the world has to offer. God doesn't forcibly wean us from our play. But when we think we are done with the play and we turn to God, He will not be found wanting. in his response. Mother comes running from the kitchen, takes the child on her lap. So we need to think that we have a mother, and we need to turn to her now and then. We look upon God as Father, God as Mother. Our parents, our God, our father and mother, their love is the most, it's the supreme kind of love. And even of those two, the mother's love is the most supreme. There is nothing superior to mother's love. That applies to our earthly mother. Now here, God as Mother. We can only imagine how profound that love is. And Holy Mother, Sri Sharada Devi said, Sri Ramakrishna left me to demonstrate the motherhood of God to this world. And when we study her life, we see how people without any qualification, competency whatsoever, people who had left no sins uncommitted, they came to Holy Mother, she gave them all refuge and gave their mind a Godward turn. So God as Mother, because this motherhood of God, there is a wonderful exposition on this in Swami Tapasyanandaji's biography of Holy Mother, Sri Sharada Devi, the Holy Mother. The very last chapter of this biography is Holy Mother as a revelation of the motherhood of God. That's a wonderful chapter known for some of Swami Tapasyanandaji's original thoughts on the subject. He says, by motherhood of God, no distinction in gender is meant. But he says, motherhood of God means God's anugraha shakti, God's power of redemption, anugraha. And only God, looking upon God as Mother, can be a fitting visualization of that anugraha shakti, power of redemption. So, establishing a different relationship with God, looking upon God as our own. Not someone to be feared, but someone to be loved, someone to get close to, and someone very close to us, someone who doesn't sit in judgment. We read Holy Mother's life. Holy Mother was the mother of her children, not their judge. So she won't judge her faults. That's a great solace for all of us. All of us, there is no dearth of faults in us. So when we go to Holy Mother, she won't pick faults in us. She won't pick holes in us. So that provides more inspiration to us. When we go to Holy Mother, she is there. If my child gets covered itself with dirt, it's my duty as its mother to cleanse it and take it on my lap. That is Holy Mother's teaching. So we cultivate a relationship with God, pray to our Ishtadevata, talk to our Ishtadevata, try as far as possible to feel closeness. There is a word in Sanskrit called saulabhya. Sulabha, sulabhata, sulabhattvam, saulabhyam. This is an abstract noun. Saulabhya means accessibility. Easily accessible. So God is easily accessible. We don't need to dwell on our undesirable past, but we need to turn more and more toward God. And Sri Ramakrishna says, if you think that you have done something bad, it's not for you to dwell on that and weaken yourself all the more. But he says, pray to God. I've done something bad, I won't repeat it. And keep your end of the bargain. I won't repeat it. It's a pact you make with God. Try not to repeat it, and that amounts to sincerity. So strengthening our devotion consists in establishing a relationship with God. Looking upon God as someone very close to us, God as our own, not someone who sits in judgment over us, but who is ready, who is looking forward to us turning our face in His direction. So in the midst of our problems, in the midst of our responsibilities, in the midst of all uncertainties in this world, in the midst of all the pairs of opposites, we try to remember God. And this becomes possible when we are steadfast in our spiritual discipline, in the morning and in the evening. Whatever time we are able to devote, we try to do it. Whether the mind wants it or not, we repeat the divine name. We try to meditate as taught by our teacher. This helps us remember God in the midst of all our responsibilities. The more we remember God, the more we grow in detachment. The more we move toward the east, the more the west is left behind. In fact, that's the only way. The more we think of God, the less we think of sense objects. Because the mind, it is with one mind we'll have to think. For one moment you try to think of God, His presence, or you pray. When you present, we discussed thinking of God's presence inside us. Another consideration is, let's send a silent prayer to God within. That moment when we send a prayer, we don't see God. God is right now X, unknown for us. We think of God, His presence, and send a silent prayer. At the moment you send the silent prayer, you cannot think of anything else. When you think of anything else, you won't be able to send the silent prayer. Which means, when you pray, howsoever brief the prayer is within, you won't be able to, there won't be any intrusion of other thoughts. If there is intrusion of other thoughts, our prayer stops. So we try to repeat the divine name with a prayerful attitude, with an attitude of seeking. When we do that, as long as this attitude of seeking remains, no other thought can intrude into our consciousness. If there is any intrusion of thought, we understand that our prayer has stopped. And again, we try to revive that prayer. So this helps us greatly in making the mind one-pointed toward God. How do we pray to a God who is unknown to us? That's a question, valid question. Someone asked this question to Swami Adbhutanandaji, Latu Maharaj. You have his biography also, how the shepherd boy became a saint, right? Mm-hmm. Swami Adbhutananda, Swami Chaitanandaji's book.
Yes.
When this question was asked to Swami Adbhutanandaji, how do you pray to a God who is unknown to you? You are unfamiliar with him. Right now that's what is the present condition. Latu Maharaj says, you are in search of a job. You shoot an application to the manager of a company. You say, I am so-and-so. You introduce yourself and then say, you will be sincere in your job. You will work to the satisfaction of your superiors, etc., etc. This was in vogue. This kind of application was in vogue several decades back. CV and all that, there is so much of fine-tuning. There are so many do's and don'ts in your CV these days. But we understand the point. We present ourselves, our candidacy for consideration by the government, by the company which is supposed to hire us, and we are sure that we will do our best. So we shoot an application to the manager of the company without having seen the manager, with the hope that he will see our application and respond to us. So says Latu Maharaj, pray to God. You're sending an application to God and you will get a response if your application is sincere. So, because God is unknown to me, it doesn't make a case for not praying to God. Because God is within. That I am not being aware of Him right now does not undermine the fact that He is within. So, we try to turn ourselves within without thinking of anything else, without thinking of our responsibilities. And these thoughts come, fine, let them come. But we don't need to get hooked to them. We let these thoughts alone. And try to hold on to the name, trying to feel the presence. All this is difficult. None of this is easy. All this is easier said than done. But we can try to do. People like Sri Ramakrishna provide us with inspiration. That when you take one step, God takes 10 steps, 100 steps toward you. And Sri Krishna gives this important teaching in the Gita. And this verse, the first half of the verse occurs twice. It goes like this. Manmana bhava madbhakto madhyaji mam namaskuru. Mame vaishyasi satyam te pratijane priyosime. In another verse, Mame vaishyasi yuktvaivam atmanam rahasisthita. Manmana bhava. That means fix your mind on me. Madbhakto bhava. Be devoted to me. Madhyaji bhava, because that bhava has to be tagged to all of these. This is an imperative teaching. Manmana bhava, fix your mind on me. Madbhakto bhava has to be added to that. Be my devotee. Madhyaji, offer everything to me. Yaji comes from yajna. Yajna here, it has fallen into disuse in these times, because yajna, fire rituals, that was That was a special teaching of the Mimamsakas, who said, you have to perform Agnihotra all your life, you have to perform some of these five rituals as Nitya Karma. If you don't do them, you incur sin, and if you do them, you are not going to get anything. If you do them selflessly, you will grow in purity of mind. So this was a fond teaching of theirs to keep people in leash, to get people yoked always to the work portion of the Vedas. Keep on doing your Nitya Karma. If you do it dispassionately, you will grow in purity of mind. If you don't do your Nitya Karma means obligatory everyday duties, you will incur sin. Sri Shankaracharya knocked this philosophy on its head. He said, non-performance of something cannot result in something positive. Akarane pratyavaya. Pratyavaya is incurring sin. Akarane, not doing something. If you are not doing your obligatory duties, you incur sin. Sri Shankaracharya knocks this on its head in his commentary on the Taittiriya Upanishad. Non-performance of something cannot result in sin. If you don't do our spiritual practices, the mind takes to its old ways again, but we are not incurring sin. But if the mind goes back to its old ways, pursuit of sense objects, and we start committing bad things, then we could probably interpret that results in sin. But it doesn't result in non-performance of that. Performance of spiritual discipline helps in strengthening the mind, helps in purifying the mind. Non-performance doesn't result in sin. Someone asked Swami Vijnanandaji, one of Sri Ramakrishna's monastic disciples, after initiation from him, suppose I don't practice spiritual disciplines regularly, what happens? He didn't say you will incur sin. He also didn't say, don't worry, I'll take care of you. He said, if you don't practice spiritual disciplines regularly, you won't be getting that which you would have got if you had practiced spiritual disciplines regularly. It is as simple as that. When we practice spiritual disciplines regularly, we gain mastery over our mind, and we don't remain enslaved by the mind and the senses anymore. And our mind grows in purity, and in this pure mind, God will reveal himself at his own will and pleasure. But spiritual disciplines discipline the senses. That's what Holy Mother teaches. She says, you don't realize God by japa, by prayer, by this or that discipline. But she says, God can be realized only by God's grace. Alright, then if you don't practice spiritual disciplines will not lead you to God. Then why should I practice spiritual disciplines? Alright, give it a try. You will get more and more devoted to the world and be in the thick of misery. The choice is ours. So Holy Mother says, why do we practice spiritual disciplines? Spiritual disciplines can curb the vigor of the senses. The senses will gain, the senses will become more disciplined, and we grow in self-mastery and strength. That is why we practice spiritual disciplines. But God will not be found wanting. We remember that. God's grace is on us, and the right moment, the right thing happens. So manmana bhava, fix your mind on me. Mad bhakto bhava, be devoted to me. Madhyaji bhava, offer everything to me. It came from this Mimamsakas thing, yajna. So offer everything to the truth within. Mam namaskuru, do prostrations before me. Mami vaishyasi satyam te, you will definitely come to me. I make this promise to you. Pratijane priyosime, you are devoted to me. That is why I make this promise. Pratijane pratignya. We are familiar with the word pratignya, promise. Pratijane in Sanskrit means I promise. So Sri Krishna makes this promise. Fix your mind on God, be devoted to God, offer everything to God, prostrate before God, and you will definitely come to God. You will definitely come to me. This is my promise to you, because you are dear to me. Of course, this topic of devotion is very, very vast topic. One thing more we'll consider from the Bhagavad Gita, 12th chapter, related to devotion. In the 12th chapter, Sri Krishna says, worship of the formless leads you to the supreme reality. But worshipping God, offering your activities to God, and growing in devotion to God also leads you to the same goal. He says, especially the worship of the formless is fraught with great difficulties and danger for a person who is body bound. Dehi, that is the word used. Dehi means one who is attached to the body, one who is embodied. All of us are embodied. But a person who grows in discrimination and purity grows in detachment from the body. He lives in the body, not as the body. So that is about worship of the formless. Worship of the formless is fraught with great difficulty for a person who is attached to his body. That means when I am conscious that I am an individual, when I am attached to my body, attached to my mind, worship of the formless doesn't help me in attaining spiritual progress. Sri Krishna says, follow the way of devotion. Sri Ramakrishna says, in this world, our mind is on food, annagata prana. That's the word he uses. That means how we are dependent on food. And we can understand, food means this annamaya kosha. Food does not mean just the food we eat, but the layer of our personality which is nurtured by food. So that means we are body bound. So in this age, the way of devotion has taught by Narada, that's the way, Sri Ramakrishna says. So the way of devotion conduces to spiritual progress. So Sri Krishna says, he prescribes four disciplines in decreasing order of difficulty. The first is, he says, fix your mind on me. Fix your buddhi on me. From then on, you will live in me alone. Manmana bhava is this. Mai eva mana adatsva, mai buddhim niveshaya, nivasishyasi mai eva, ata urdvam na samshaya. 12th chapter. Fix your mind on me. Clear, relatively clear. Think of God, repeating his name, hear his glories, try to visualize his presence. That is fixing the mind on God. Now, what is meant by fixing the buddhi on God? Fixing the buddhi on God, we understand this, what this means from Sri Ramanuja's commentary. Buddhi, we have seen, is the seat of determination, conviction, discrimination, decision making. It is the seat of the will. So it's the seat of conviction for our consideration here. Sri Ramanuja says, fixing the buddhi on God means having a firm conviction, developing and strengthening a firm conviction that God is the only truth to be attained in life. That means orienting ourselves toward the spiritual reality, the spiritual goal. God alone is to be attained in life. Cultivating this conviction and strengthening this conviction is what is meant by fixing the buddhi on God. So Sri Krishna says, fix your mind on me, fix your buddhi on me, and from then on, ata urdvam. Sri Shankaracharya interprets this as after the fall of the body. But Sri Ramanuja gives a more acceptable interpretation. Sri Ramanuja says, ata urdvam means from then, from that moment onward. When you fix your mind on God, when you fix your buddhi on God, from then on, you will live in me alone. Nivasishyasi mai eva ata urdvam na samshayam. There is no doubt in this. So that is the first discipline Sri Krishna gives, of the four disciplines. Fixing the mind on God, easier said than done. Fixing the buddhi on God, that means orienting our mind toward the spiritual goal. And then, from then on, you begin to live in me. This is the most difficult thing. That means this is the most difficult, then relatively less difficult is the next discipline. If you are not able to do this, take recourse to the yoga of practice. Abhyasa Yoga. Repeatedly practice thinking of God. That's what we do, spiritual practice. Repeated practice. Repeatedly orienting the mind toward the ideal. Repeatedly reflecting on the fact that God alone is to be attained and this world is transitory. And the world cannot be a place from which you can get infinite bliss. You can get only happiness that always alternates with misery. So this reflection, we practice. We practice, take recourse to the yoga of practice, says Sri Krishna. If you are not able to fix your mind on God, fix your buddhi on God, take recourse to the yoga of practice. If you are not able to do this also, practice number 3. Do work for my sake. Do work for God's sake. By that you will come to me. Doing work for God's sake means assisting in worship, worshipping God, assisting others who are performing worship, and rendering service in a temple. So these are all straightforward meanings. But you need to have a derived meaning also, because we don't get to offer the service of do work for God's sake. We are unable to involve ourselves in any temple activity. If we are able to involve ourselves, we do it as worship. That is working for God. But working for God also means what Swami Vivekananda taught, looking upon others as manifestations of God and offering service to them. Whatever service we are able to offer to others, looking upon that service as worship of God. God dwells in me, so he does in others. So my service to others is worship of the God that dwells in them. So I don't expect any return of favor. I don't expect even gratitude by the service. So looking upon others as children of God and serving them, that also amounts to doing God's work. If you're not able to do this also, fourth discipline. Discipline your mind and offer whatever you do to God. Sarva karma palatyagam tatah kuru yatatmavan. Yatatmavan means with a controlled mind. This controlling mind, the disciplining the mind, doesn't figure in the first 3 disciplines. Because there we try to think of God, we try to fix our mind on God, fix buddhi on God, or we take recourse to spiritual, we take recourse to the yoga of practice. Or in the third, we try to do work for God's sake. So you have devotion. All these 3 disciplines laced with devotion. And I am unable to follow any of those disciplines. So here Sri Krishna says, offer everything you do to God. So here, all our secular activities, whatever I do, I offer to God. But here, I need to make special efforts, since thoughts of God don't arise in me spontaneously. And I try to do work, and I try to offer it at the end of the day, at the end of the work, to God himself. So I need to specially see that the mind doesn't stray beyond a point. It doesn't go down beyond a point. I don't give a free rein to the mind, but rein it in all the time. So that is the fourth discipline. Supposed to be the least difficult, but all disciplines are difficult. Thinking of anything other than sense objects is difficult. So offer all your actions to me, looking upon your actions as worship, that will also undoubtedly bring you to me. The next quality, cultivate qualities like self-control. Shantyadi parichiyatam. Shanti. Shanti is peace. Shanti comes from the root, shama. Shama is shanti. Shama, dama. These are 2 disciplines. Shama means control of the mind. Dhamma means control of external organs. That means exercising some kind of a quality control at the 5 gateways of our being, of our body. The ears, the skin, the eyes, the tongue, and the nose. So we exercise quality control. As spiritual seekers, we cannot afford to take in anything and everything that our senses want to take in. So we only take in wholesome things, only things that will help strengthen the mind. But we have also to be careful about what we take in through the mind in the form of ideas. We cannot afford to read any and every book. There are infinite number of books, and you have the internet, a huge explosion of knowledge. We need to be picky, we need to be choosy in what we have to study. We don't need to study because we like the cover of a book, and because it is a New York Times bestseller. A spiritual seeker doesn't care for all this marketing gimmicks. He only studies with a view to strengthening his conviction. So, Shanti, it comes from Shama. Shama is control of the mind, and Dhamma is control of the sense organs. So we need to exercise control at the mental level if we have to control at the physical level. So control of the mind is more fundamental, more important. So control of the senses, control of the mind, cultivate qualities like self-control. Sri Krishna says in the Gita, 6th chapter, our own mind is our friend, our own mind is our enemy. Uplift yourself by yourself. That's an important imperative in the 6th chapter of the Gita. Uddharet Atmana Atmanam. Uplift yourself by yourself. That means we cannot live our spiritual life by proxy. Our guru cannot live our spiritual life. He can show us the way. We have to walk the way ourselves. God cannot live our spiritual life by God cannot live our spiritual life for us. We have teachings, we have been shown the way, but we have to live the spiritual life ourselves. That is what is meant by uplifting yourself by yourself. Uplifting the unruly mind with the help of buddhi. That is another interpretation. When we distance ourselves from the mind, we abide as buddhi. And buddhi, when we translate it as intellect, we think this is the seat of the intellect, head. But Sri Shankara makes it very clear in his commentaries that the heart is the seat of buddhi. Buddhau, hridi, guhayam, these are all synonymous words. In the 13th chapter, you have this important verse, 13th chapter of the Gita. Jyotisham apitat jyotihi, tamasav paramuchyate, jnanam, jnayam, jnanagamyam, hridi sarvasya vishtitam. The light of all lights is beyond all darkness. And that is knowledge. That is what is to be known. And that is the end of all knowledge. And that abides in the heart of all human beings. Hridi sarvasya vishtitam. Hridi in Hridaya. Shankara, wherever this occurs in Hridaya, he writes Hridi buddhav. That means in the buddhi. When we understand buddhi as that aspect of our personality which is detached from the mind, body and senses, we understand that it doesn't have its locus in the head. When we say intellect, reason, we think it's the head that comes into play. That's a traditional kind of thing. And we also have, when you have a conflict between the head and the heart, follow the heart. So all this goes to deeply settled idea that buddhi has something to do with the head. By head, what do we mean? Brain. But buddhi is not located in the brain. But the brain is a precious instrument. If the brain is impaired for any reason, buddhi cannot function because we don't have the instrument. If our eyes, we lose our eyesight for any reason, we won't be able to see. The mind is there, buddhi is there. The brain center is there, ready to receive stimulus from external objects. And the optic nerve is also there. But the eye as an organ has some malfunctioning. We are not able to see. But that doesn't mean the eye is the supreme thing. It's an instrument, and if that instrument fails, I still am able to live. So the mind. When we distance ourselves from the mind, when we do what we believe to be beneficial without waiting for our mind's blessings, our mind is not going to bless us with, all right, do your spiritual practice, I'll cooperate with you. For a long, long time, the mind is going to act as our enemy. The mind is not trustworthy for a long, long time. This is a fundamental thing we have to understand. We cannot afford to let the mind think noble thoughts for us. It will never think. After thousands of thoughts, maybe one thought, So we need to consciously fill the mind with noble thoughts. That means we who are different from the mind, fill the mind with noble thoughts. We who are different from the mind is buddhi. And where does the mind dwell? The mind? The mind is in the hand, mind is in the heart, the mind is in the head, the mind is in the feet, the mind is everywhere, the mind is all pervading. When I touch my head, or if someone touches my head, I am able to feel the touch. Someone touches my leg, I am able to feel the touch. I am able to feel the touch because the mind gets connected to that part of the body. But if for any reason I lose consciousness here, that is because of the deficiency of this particular part of the body. So even though the mind is connected, the stimulus doesn't reach the mind. So the mind is from the head to foot anywhere. And if by spiritual practice we are able to withdraw the mind from a particular part of the body, we are not aware of any sensation in that part of the body. Sri Ramana Maharshi, he was a knower of the self. And he had to undergo surgery for his cancerous growth in his left arm. And doctors wanted to take him to Madras from Tiruvannamalai, a few hours drive. But ever since he came to Tiruvannamalai, when he was about 12 years old, he never left the place. Maximum a radius of 1 or 2 miles, he never left the place Tiruvannamalai. So he said that if they wanted to do surgery, they could do it in Tiruvannamalai itself. So they made a makeshift kind of hospital, and doctors came from Madras and then operated on him. But he refused to take any kind of chloroform or any kind of anesthesia. So he said, when you say you're ready for the surgery, tell me. And then they told him, he withdrew his mind from that part of the body. He who was different from the mind withdrew the mind from that part of the body. So sensations of pain emanating from that surgery failed to get connected to the mind, so it didn't affect him. Swami Turiyanandaji, Sri Ramakrishna's disciple, he had surgery for carbuncle growth on his back. There again, he withdrew his mind and they went about surgery. But later, when the doctors came to dress the wound, he was not given warning that they were about to dress. So he was in his normal consciousness. So when they touched the wound, he shrieked with pain. So he said, you should have told me. If they had told him, he would have withdrawn his mind. What a great thing even to contemplate. He could just withdraw the mind from the body, so that part of the body, even if it was cut by a weapon, sensations didn't penetrate inside. So that is, these people were the Atman, which is superior to the Buddhi also. But we can abide as Buddhi. Buddhi is, when mind is all-pervading, head to foot, Buddhi is also all-pervading. And when we have to discipline the mind, we have to abide as the buddhi. There's no other way. As long as we remain one with the mind, mind discipline is out of the question. We get disciplined by the mind. The mind takes us for a ride. The mind thinks of something. I go with the mind to San Francisco. I go with the mind, as I said, 40 years back to my younger days. So this is the mind for us. But when I have an upper hand over the mind, I am able to arrest the outward activity of the mind. Whatever be the terminology, but buddhi, let's understand, is that aspect of our being superior to the mind. And this teaching is not manufactured. Third chapter of the Gita, Indriyani Paranyahu, the senses are said to be superior to everything outside, sense objects. Indriyebhya param manaha, superior to the senses is the manas. Manasastu para buddhihi, superior to the mind is buddhi. Yo buddhev paratastu saha, superior to the buddhi is the Atman. So these are teachings about our own personality. This is not about Vedanta, this is not dry Vedanta. But it is, it speaks of our own personality. Atman means I, the true I, and Indriyani, that means senses, sense organs, my own sense organs. It speaks about me. When I think on these lights, when I think on this light, these teachings suddenly become alive. They are no more dry Vedanta. My senses are superior to sense objects. My mind is superior to the senses because it is subtler and more superior. And Buddhi is superior to the mind, and the Atman is superior to Buddhi, and there is nothing superior to the Atman. Third chapter of the Gita. This is the hierarchy of human personality. It speaks about us, it speaks about me, it speaks about you. Then suddenly it makes sense. Otherwise it is just dry Vedanta. It speaks about Indriya, it speaks about Manas. What is Manas? What is Buddhi? We hear so many times, we study so many times, but what is Buddhi? This keeps on eluding us. And especially if we are fixated on the translation intellect, we seal our own understanding. That's what I look upon. That's how I look upon it. So we understand this teaching of the Gita. So what I mean to say is, this is not something I manufacture. This is this from the Gita. Senses, mind, buddhi, self. That is the ascending hierarchy of our human personality. And we have to abide as buddhi. Or let's say, let's abide as an entity. Forget about the label. We abide as an entity different from the mind. That will, only that will help us not to the line of the mind. So it is with the help of buddhi that we accomplish self-control. Sri Krishna says in the 6th chapter, our own mind is our friend, our own mind is our enemy. And he says, an uncontrolled mind acts as our enemy, and a controlled mind acts as our friend. If it acts as our friend, we won't have difficulty in practicing spiritual disciplines. But it most of the time acts as our enemy. And it will continue to act as our enemy until it becomes our friend. It becomes our friend when it is controlled. So until it is controlled, it's not trustworthy. This a spiritual seeker keeps in mind. My mind says, all right, today you didn't have time for spiritual practice. We'll try to compensate tomorrow. Not doing spiritual practice adequately today leaves an impression in my mind which builds into the impression a tendency to repeat it tomorrow. So tomorrow, if I do 200 less today, tomorrow I'll do 300 less. I won't be able to compensate this shortfall of 200 tomorrow. Not to speak of not compensating this 200 deficit today. I won't do even my normal thing tomorrow, because doing less and thinking that I'll compensate tomorrow has become an impression with a tendency to repeat it, as we saw earlier. So the mind is not something, it is not safe to entrust ourselves to the care of this mind which has not been disciplined for a spiritual seeker. So we have to have this one-upmanship with regard to the mind. Don't trust the mind. If we are not able to practice adequately, right, it's okay. God is not going to take it against us. But let's not trust the mind. We'll compensate tomorrow. It hardly ever happens. We all of us know with our experience. So let's try to cultivate devotion to God. Give up trusting the mind. But we need to keep on disciplining the mind, because the mind is a precious instrument. But the mind is also a storehouse of all our impressions, all our samskaras, where are embedded all our desires. So we need to continue to culture the mind, discipline the mind, knowing that only a disciplined mind can be our friend. So our attempts are to befriend the mind by gradually coaxing it. It's like a spoiled child, but we need to be at it. We need to continuously practice spiritual disciplines. Sri Krishna says in the Gita, every time the mind strays, bring it back patiently with the help of buddhi. Buddhya dhriti grihitaya yato yato nischarati manas chanchalam astiram tatastato niyamyet atmanneva vasham naye. Elsewhere he says, shanai shanai ruparame buddhya dhriti grihitaya. Gradually, slowly, control the mind with the help of buddhi, buddhya. Dhriti, that means will in action, fortitude. With the help of a will that is in action, with the help of buddhi, gradually bring back the mind on the object of your meditation. Atma samstam mana kritva nakinchid api chintayet. Once you settle your mind on the Atman, don't think of anything else. And every time the mind strays, bring it back patiently. Bring it back patiently on the ideal. The mind keeps on drifting. The mind is fickle. The mind is obstinate. The mind is stubborn. How to control this mind? There is Arjuna's question. And Arjuna, we know his power of concentration. We know how he won the hands of Draupadi. He had to shoot at a target, revolving target, above, looking at its reflection below in a pool of water. Looking at the reflection below, he had to shoot the arrow above, and the target was revolving. And Arjuna did it. He could fill the target. That was Arjuna's power of concentration. And he said, this mind is fickle, this mind is obstinate, this mind is stubborn. To control this mind, I think, is like to control the wind. Sixth chapter. Sri Krishna says, yes, the mind is obstinate, the mind is fickle, but it can be controlled by two things, practice and detachment. Abhyasa and Vairagya. Along with practice should go detachment also. Because we practice on the one hand, but we don't detach ourselves from anything that will ruin our practice. So anything that comes in the way of our practice, we should resolutely detach ourselves from. Swami Vivekananda says, what should we detach ourselves from? In other words, what should we give up? Anything that we consume physically, mentally, morally, spiritually, reject as poison. Swami Vivekananda, we remember this teaching. Anything that weakens us physically, mentally, morally, and spiritually, reject as poison. This rejection should go hand in hand with our practice. We practice cultivating devotion to God, but at the same time, we resolutely give up anything that will weaken us. So we are on the subject of cultivating qualities like self-control. The mind doesn't spontaneously dwell on God. The mind is restless. The mind is in a state of motion all the time. And as long as we are one with this mind, we are also in a state of motion. Front to the future, back to the past. We hardly are in the present, because that's not the mode of the mind. The mind, by definition, is in a state of flux. The mind, by definition, is in a state of motion. A succession of thoughts makes us infer the mind. Just as a succession of events gets us the concept of time. Imagine there are no events. No events at all. We don't have a concept of time. Past, present, one event leading to another. That leading to another. That is causation. So the principle of causality, desha, kala, and nimitta. Nimitta is this causation. This causation, the idea of causation, one event leading to another, gives us the concept of time. A succession of events makes us infer time. Similarly, a succession of thoughts makes us infer the mind. The mind is nothing but all these bundle of thoughts. And when there are no thoughts, there is no mind. When there is only one thought, to the exclusion of everything else, when there is only one divine thought to the exclusion of everything else, that time also the mind dies. Only buddhi is there. Buddhi is only one thought, buddhi oriented toward the Atman. And when that also, in the moment of realization, this thought also stops, we abide as the Atman. In Sri Ramakrishna's language, a pure mind, a pure buddhi, and pure Atman are one and the same. When the mind becomes pure, it is devoid of any other thought. It merges in the buddhi. And when buddhi also merges in the Atman in the moment of realization. So buddhi is a precious instrument. That's a point we try to keep in mind. So that's about self-control. Controlling, cultivating control of the mind, control of the senses. We have some time for reflection if you have any questions. Or we'll continue with our study, whichever way you prefer.
I have to do one question.
Yes, please go.
Sri Ramakrishna said, you will act as a maid servant in rich man's house. So, That means that even if you are working in a rich man's house, your mind is always where your children are, all those things. But see, I read in Sri Ramakrishna Gospel one time, when the servant's work is done from the rich man's house, the relation between the rich man and the servant is over. That means we work in rich man's house just to earn money or do our duty for our living, like we work in other places.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
No, right,
so
yes.
There will be no relationship. When the work is over, everything is over with the rich man.
Yes, when the work is over means when we leave this world, we have no more relationship with husband, wife, children. But until, as long as we are alive, because we apply this example to our everyday life. The example has its own limited connotation. The maidservant, as long as she works, she is aware that these are not her children. She looks upon them as if they are her children. She is aware that her own place is elsewhere. But this, her being aware that her own children are elsewhere, does not mean that she is distracted during her work, because this example is not expected to convey that. The example conveys this idea that she looks upon the rich man's children as if they are her children and serves them to the best of her ability.
Yes, she has to, because she is getting
salary.
Salary
also. Yes.
But and when the job is done, she will not have any relation.
Precisely. Similarly, so here when the job is done, apply it to our everyday life. When the job is done, that means when our connection with our wife, husband, or children is severed by death, we have nothing to do with them. Until we are with them, we have a responsibilities to them. We try to discharge our responsibilities, looking upon them as master's children. Though he is my husband or she is my wife, and these are my children, I look upon them as God's children and serve them in that light. And when my service is over, that means my responsibilities in this world are over. When death brings a separation, I have nothing more to do. I can concentrate more and more on my spiritual practice and pray to God. But as long as I am in the world, I have responsibilities to my family. I continue to do it in this, with this attitude. Yes, that's right. She has nothing more to do once her responsibilities are over. So we don't need to wait till that point of death to experience the detachment. We can experience the detachment even here as we continue to follow this teaching. But as long as we continue to live in the world, as long as we have our relations to attend to, as long as we have responsibilities, we discharge those responsibilities with this attitude, and we grow in detachment even while discharging our responsibilities. Yes, once we do that, we really don't have anyone to call our own. We'll continue to do our responsibilities, but in our mind we'll be free from attachment. We will have love for them, but we won't be attached to them. We'll be attached to God instead.
Consciousness and Buddhi?
Consciousness is the Atman. Buddhi is an instrument. Buddhi is a function of the mind. When you say mind, all its four functions are implied. The first is the function of deliberation. The deliberation is weighing the pros and cons of anything. Or let's say you have a problem, and you have possible four solutions to this problem. When you consider the pros and cons of these four solutions, you have not arrived at any decision right now, but you are still considering. You are still deliberating on these different options. When that happens, that particular function of the mind is called manas. Manas. But when we choose to solve this problem according to, let's say, solution number two, Buddhi comes into picture. decision, firmness, conviction, determination, no vacillation, buddhi comes into picture. You have a third function of the mind called I-feeling, ahankara. Here ahankara by ahankara is not meant any negative quality, but the feeling of I. I see you in front of me. There is no bad order to this I. I see a harmonium in front of me. I know that this is so and so. That is the feeling of I. There is a fourth function. Storehouse of memories, chitta. That I is called ahankara. The fourth function of the mind is called chitta. Chitta itself can imply the mind based on context. When you say chitta shuddhi, it means purity of the mind. Yogas chitta vritti nirodha, again mind. But chitta is a definite function of the mind, which means the storehouse of knowledge, storehouse of memories, storehouse of samskaras, impressions. They are all in the mind. Now we understand one important thing. These are four functions of the mind, and based on the functions, we give them different names. Manas, the deliberative faculty. Buddhi, the determinative faculty. Ahankara, the feeling of I. And Chitta, the storehouse of memories and impressions. These are not watertight compartments. It is the one mind called by different names based on its functions. So buddhi is also an aspect of the mind. Buddhi also is part of the mind. But by cultivating buddhi, we can gain mastery over the mind. But in self-realization, buddhi also is merged in the self, the Atman. So consciousness means the spirit, the Atman. Buddhi functions because consciousness percolates to that level of the buddhi. Mind functions because consciousness descends further. Senses function because consciousness descends to the level of the senses. The body is able to function because consciousness descends to the level of the body. And what is that consciousness? I am that consciousness. You are that consciousness. The real you is that consciousness. So we give, buddhi is also matter, subtle matter. Manas is matter. Considering that buddhi is part of the mind, mind is also matter. When you say mind is matter, buddhi is also matter. But it's a matter of a different kind, different from the body. The matter called body is destroyed at death when you cremate the body. But the matter called mind is subtle, it survives physical death. But this subtle matter called the mind also is subject to destruction by the light of self-knowledge. So when I realize that I am the spirit, that light kills the mind also. But until then the mind persists. The mind is stubborn, the mind is subtle. So considering buddhi to be part of the mind, one of the functions of the mind, buddhi is also matter, subtle matter. But buddhi, the determinative faculty, helps us gain mastery over the deliberative faculty. And buddhi is the seat of the will, and we discipline the mind with the help of the will. But the Atman is the spirit that is the substratum of body, mind, senses, buddhi. Everything other than the spirit is the substratum for that. Consciousness. Consciousness with a capital C. We are conscious of a touch. I am conscious that someone is sitting in front of me. That is consciousness with a lowercase c. And that consciousness with a lowercase c is possible because of the consciousness with a capital C, which is the Atman. So it is the Atman, the spirit, that lets our body, senses and mind function. And it's an unfortunate fact that we, that consciousness, capital C, we let this inert matter called mind come to life. We energize the mind with consciousness that we are. and that energized mind takes this consciousness for a ride. What an interesting thing. If I detach myself, myself means the consciousness that I am from the mind will cease to dance and also make me dance to its tunes. So it is I who energize the mind, give it life, and follow it blindly like a slave. How is this? That is what it is. There is no how. The dance is there. How I escape from this noose of this mind? In the Sankhya philosophy, they posit two realities, Prakriti and Purusha. Purusha is the spirit. Prakriti is nature. And the nature in Vedanta or in Sankhya is meant everything other than the spirit. By nature does not mean only the natural scenery that is perceivable by the senses, but by nature is meant everything from mind down to the body and to everything outside. So Prakriti means anything that is other than the spirit. This entire world, mental world, physical world, these are all nothing but evolutes of Prakriti. So this Prakriti, the equivalent word in Vedanta is Maya. Prakriti is supposed to entice all the Purushas with its dance. So the Purusha is enamored of the Prakriti's dance, and that proximity of a Purusha to Prakriti explains this creation, explains our misery. But when a person realizes that he is the Purusha, he is the spirit, Prakriti's dance ceases for him. But she continues to dance to lure the others. So Prakriti's dance is eternal. I choose not to be lured by her dance anymore. That means Maya's lures, Maya's enticements, I am free from all that. When I become free, Prakriti's dance ceases for me, but she continues to dance for the benefit of others who are happy with the dance. So this world is eternal in a way. The dance of Prakriti, the dance of Maya, these allurements will continue. But it stops for me. So there is no wholesale salvation. Everyone will become free. At whatever point, they become free. But this entire world becoming free and reducing this entire world and living beings to zero, once again starting from a clean slate, will not happen. Because the world as a mixture of good and evil, as a mixture of bound and free people, are bound, free people, struggling people, and some of those who are struggling becoming free, that mixture will continue to remain because that mixture defines the world. This world is eternal that way. That way, that is relative eternal nature of the world. But what is eternal is only the spirit. So when I know that I am the spirit, this world doesn't hold any lures for me later. So that is it. I am the spirit. To realize that I am the spirit, to realize God, that means self-realization or God-realization, all of these are synonymous terms. Because God is nothing but the spirit, manifest in a particular form, to suit my mental temperament. So Vedanta says we are essentially that spirit, not the body, not the mind, not the senses. So we are divine. In Swami Vivekananda's language, we are all potentially divine. And the goal is to manifest this divinity within. That's the idea. And for this manifestation, Buddhi is a great help. We abide as Buddhi every time we do something that is beneficial to us, scoring a point over the mind. Every time we succumb to the mind without batting an eyelid, we remain one with the mind, we remain enslaved by the mind and the senses, and Buddhi remains dormant. Buddhi is in hibernation. Buddhi can awaken only by ascertaining our freedom from the mind, having an ideal, exercising discrimination between what is right and what is wrong, holding on to what is right, and resolutely giving up what is wrong. Only that can conclusively, in howsoever small measure, give us the understanding that we are buddhi, or use any other label, different from the mind, different from the senses, different from the body. And this realization, as I said, in however small measure it is fundamental to making our spiritual practice meaningful. When we abide as buddhi, we are able to do our japa, spiritual practice, without being unnerved by thoughts arising in the mind. We are able to do work better. When we do work, the mind goes somewhere else. The hands are busy with work, the mind goes somewhere else. And unfortunately, I go along with the mind. But when I abide as buddhi, I am able to practice what Swami Vivekananda taught. Whenever you are doing anything, do not think of anything beyond. Do it as worship, as the highest worship, and devote your whole life to it for the time being. That is Swami Vivekananda's teaching on Karma Yoga in a nutshell. Whenever you are doing anything, do not think of anything beyond. The mind wants to think of everything beyond. Do not think of anything beyond means don't go with the mind thinking those things. Let the mind think those things. You don't follow the mind. That means detach yourself from the mind. Do not think of anything beyond means do not let your mind think of anything beyond. Unless you're different from the mind that thinks of everything beyond, this kind of karma yoga is not possible. So karma yoga is to essentially separate the will from the hold of the mind, senses and the body. And this separated will, this purified will, buddhi, is directed within toward the truth. That is, we remember the hierarchy of the Bhagavad Gita. Senses, mind, buddhi, spirit. And as spiritual seekers, our challenge is to snap the connection between buddhi and mind. Leave the mind, senses and body and everything outside to take care of themselves. And buddhi has to orient itself toward God. Sri Ramakrishna said, may the body and pain take care of themselves. O mind, you learn to dwell in bliss. May the body, which includes a subtle body called the mind, may the body and pain take care of themselves. O mind, here it's addressed to the buddhi, you learn to dwell in bliss. And buddhi dwells in the bliss. In bliss means in the spirit. It becomes insulated from everything outside of it. So that's the challenge in spiritual life. And we accomplish this challenge. We face this challenge according to the path that is shown to us, according to the spiritual technique that is taught to us. We try to steadfastly do it. Not trying to experiment with one technique today, the second tomorrow, the third the day after, dig for water here, 10 feet, and in the second place, tomorrow another 10 feet, and so on and so forth, not finding water anywhere. But steadfastly digging in the same place, 50 feet, might fetch us water. That is Sri Ramakrishna's example again. So these techniques can differ from individual to individual. Bhakti Yoga, Karma Yoga, Raja Yoga, Jnana Yoga, these are all different techniques to separate the will from the mind and focus it on the truth within. Any other question or we can conclude?
I had an observation regarding the Sadhu Sangha. When Narendra met the master for the second time, his famous song had that line, Sadhu Sangha Nave Ase Je Ram Santa Hole Seta Raviyo Vistram Pato Vranta Hole Sudaibe Pat Se Panta Nivas Jam.
Yes, you take refuge in the rest house. When you are tired in your journey. Mano Chalo Nijya Niketane. That's a very wonderful song. Sri Ramakrishna was very happy with that song. Swamiji, Sri Ramakrishna asked Swamiji to sing that song. Yes, that Sadhu Sangha is a rest house to free yourself from any fatigue on the journey, exhaustion, right? That's a very meaningful song. Mono Cholo Nijo Niketone. Right?
Yes.
What is the second line? You translate the second line. Or the first two lines. Oh mind, you go back to your own abode.
Yes.
The first.
Yes.
And the second
line. Shomsharo Bideshe Bideshiro Veshe.
Right. That means you have come to
this
foreign
world.
Land of
the foreign land.
Of this world. Shomsharo
Bidish. Why are you roaming around endlessly?
Right. This world itself is a foreign land for you.
And
that means your own abode is the truth within.
Inside.
So you are roaming about in this strange world, foreign world. Right?
Videshiro Beshe. As a foreigner, we are roaming around in the foreign land.
Right. Yeah, that's
no,
a very...
No, no. Neither the world is mine, and even I don't belong to the world, I am also a foreigner here. This is not my abode. My abode is there.
I think you have this song in the gospel, translated in the gospel, right?
Yes.
All right, we'll conclude here for today. Jananim Sharadam Devim Ramakrishnam Jagadgurum Padapadme Tayo Shritva Pranamami Mohur Mohur. We take refuge at the feet of Holy Mother Sri Sharada Devi and Great Master Sri Ramakrishna. Our salutations to them over and over again. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto us. Peace be unto all.